So did you remember to buy Scantrons? Cool, no problems getting them. This is just a guess as to where we were. Are we on slide 8? I already talked about it, though, a little bit, right? Okay, so the idea here is that chirality is a big deal because when there's a left-handed and a right-handed version of a molecule, and it's a signal, like a drug or a hormone, it will work only if it has the right-handedness because it has to fit well into a receptor. And S and R is just one standard. Unfortunately, there's not a single standard that chemists use. S and R is one standard, S meaning sinistral or left-handed, R meaning recto or right-handed. We see in slide 9 the same idea, it's chirality, but this shows you a different standard that chemists use. They classify them as left-handed or right-handed different ways, and therefore they have to have different naming schemes. But L means levo, which is left, and D means dextro, which is right. In this case, L-DOPA is the stuff that actually works in your brain. D-DOPA doesn't. We don't make D-DOPA, we make L-DOPA. Okay, let's go to 10 now. And these particular molecules are just examples, so that's the point of this is not actually what estradiol is and what testosterone is specifically. You might already know that estradiol is an estrogen. There are multiple estrogens, but estradiol is the main estrogen. And testosterone, you almost certainly have heard of. These are hormones. More specifically, they are steroid hormones produced by animals. And these have very, very different effects, right? Estrogens are feminizing hormones. Testosterone is a masculizing hormone. So very, very different effects in the body. But you can see by these structural formulae that we're looking at that they're very similar molecularly. And in matter of fact, they start out identically because animals use a precursor molecule to form all of their steroid hormones from. It all starts out as the same stuff in animals. Anyone know what that molecule is, by the way? It's a molecule that animals produce, can't live without it for multiple reasons, including the fact that we make all the steroid hormones out of it. That is cholesterol. And cholesterol, if you were to look at it as a structural formula, looks pretty much just like these, almost identical. The only really difference is minor adjustments to these things that are highlighted in blue, which is the only reason that these two molecules are different from each other, because they don't have the same things that are highlighted in blue. And it's the things that are highlighted in blue that's really the point of this slide. What do we call these things highlighted in blue as a total? I don't mean what are they specifically. I mean, what are these examples of that we just barely got into in the lab last time? They are functional groups, yes. So the point of the slide is to introduce you to the notion of functional groups. A functional group is not, as you can see here, a complete molecule. A functional group is just a pretty small collection of atoms arranged in a certain way, but that are part of a bigger molecule. And the reason that functional groups got their name as an overall category is that a particular functional group, whatever it is, if it's there in a molecule, will give that molecule particular functions. It will allow it to act in a certain chemical way and therefore have biological functions. That's why they're called functional groups. And CH3, C double bonded to O, OH, those are all functional group examples. Now, we were just barely introduced to functional groups in last week's lab, like I was saying, but I told you that I would eventually lecture on them. So starting with slide 11, it's really, if you were looking at this in a textbook, it would be all one table for 11 and 12. But we're going to go through the functional groups one by one. so that you can know them not only for Wednesday's test, but as I said in lab last time, you also need to know them for the lab. Of course, that shouldn't be a problem because by the time you get to lab, you're already done with the test. If this were a an organic chemistry course, you would have to know a longer list of functional groups. So this is not all of the functional groups that exist, but the ones that we're going to cover for this course are the ones that are really important to biology. And I'll explain why or give a couple examples of why they are important biologically. But we'll start with the first one, which is hydroxyl. Actually, in each of these, this what I'm about to say doesn't apply just to the first column, but in each of these you notice that at the top you get a couple pictures of them, of each one. They're pictured a couple different ways, as a ball and stick model, but also as a structural formula representation. And you can tell if you didn't have anything but those pictures, no words, you could still, and I didn't already tell you this, you would still be able to tell that a functional group is not a complete molecule. How do you know that? Just from the pictures. Yeah, either one actually will tell you why they're not a complete molecule.
Like the line is trailing off there.
That's exactly. And what does the line represent?
A bond that's not fully represented.
Right. It's a bond that needs to be completed, but since there's nothing at the other end of that bond, that line, either the stick in the ball and stick model or the line in the structural model, that means it's not a complete molecule. So a functional group is connected to something. Well, this book uses one option, which is to just not have anything at all on the other end of the line. But you could, for instance, for hydroxyl, write it as ROH. In other words, they just didn't bother putting the R. But R is another way you can represent these. What does R actually stand for? Well, it stands for residue. Residue is just a word that means everything that's left over. So the residue is the rest of the molecule, the thing that this functional group is just part of, and it's connected to the rest of it. So you could write hydroxyl as R-OH, but it doesn't matter which side the R is on either, right? I mean, you can turn a molecule around. So it could be HO-R. But it can't be OH-R. This one's wrong. What's wrong with this one?
Because it's connected to the oxygen, not hydrogen.
Right. Hydrogen has a valence of what?
Just
one. So it can only ever make one bond. It has one hole in the ball and stick model. So it's already using that bond with oxygen. It can't form another one. Plus, oxygen in this case, is only making one, and it has to make two. So this is wrong. But you can write it as HO-R, and similarly for the other pictures. But let's talk particularly about hydroxyl, which is the first functional group of the list. And these aren't ordered by importance or anything. Hydroxyl is a pretty simple functional group. Simply an oxygen bonded to a hydrogen, and then the oxygen is also bonded to the residue, the rest of the molecule. This happens pretty often, so there's all kinds of molecules that have a hydroxyl functional group. For all of the molecules that have at least one hydroxyl group, we lump them into a category because of that, and we call that category of substances alcohols. So we tend to think when we use the word alcohol day to day, as though there's only one alcohol. Well, there's many, many alcohols. And what we call alcohol, usually what we mean by that is specifically ethanol, which is their example. This is the one that you built with the ball and stick model. That's just one of many alcohols, though. The nomenclature is important because there's all kinds of substances, and it's helpful to use names that remind you of what things are. That's why alcohol is a category, it's not a specific substance, but if you have an example of an alcohol, it's given a name that ends in OL to remind you that it's an alcohol, like ethanol. And notice, by the way, that if instead of this hydroxyl group in ethanol, if that were just another hydrogen, it would be a hydrocarbon with two carbons and no double bonds, which is called ethane, right? So ethanol is the name that means ethane-like alcohol. It has an OH instead of an H. And ethanol is the beverage alcohol. It's the same exact chemical, whether it's beer, wine, or spirits. But many, many other alcohols exist. As a matter of fact, if I temporarily go back to slide 10, both of these, just estradiol is an alcohol. Notice its name ends in O-L. And the reason it's a diol, di means two, is because it has a hydroxyl here and here. So it's actually doubly an alcohol. Okay, so alcohols end in OH. Now, biologically, this is important because of things we've already been talking that are that's true of water. Think of a water molecule, right? It's an oxygen bonded to two hydrogens. So there's really two OH bonds in there, and that gave water all kinds of special properties. All those properties stem from the fact that of the fact that water is what? Where did all those special things about water come from?
Polarization?
Yes, water is a polar substance. And why is it polar? Why is an OH bond polar?
Because
What is the property that whose value is different drastically in oxygen compared to hydrogen? What word is he looking for? Electronegativity. Right. The greediness of an atom for electrons, basically, is what it is. And oxygen's is much higher than hydrogen. That's why an OH bond is polar, like in water. Well, a hydroxyl gives that molecule polarity at that end. And therefore, it interacts with polar molecules, just like when you did the solvent properties thing last time. Polar things dissolve well in polar things, but not in nonpolar things. It's also important biologically because all monosaccharides, which are the main fuels in all cells, not just your cells, just cells in general of organisms, all monosaccharides contain OH, so that all sugars, all simple sugars, are alcohols as well, just like the glucose one that you built, right? There were OHs in it. Okay, carbonyl is next. And it's different from these other ones that we're studying, most of which we still haven't gotten to, in that it has two unsatisfied bonds. It has two lines hanging off of it, notice. And because of that, there's two categories of substances that contain it, because there's two ways that this carbonyl group can appear in a molecule. I'll explain those ways in a second, but let's first look at the picture and see what actually defines it as a carbonyl. The carbon that's part of the name carbonyl is one of the atoms. It's double bonded to an oxygen, as you see. So in the ball and stick models, you used a pair of springs for that. But notice that one of these two functional group atoms is a carbon. So the carbon that's a part of a carbonyl group, if it's there in the molecule, that carbon is also part of the overall carbon skeleton of the entire molecule, just like in other organic compounds. We've talked about the carbon skeleton before, right? It's just the carbons themselves. And everything else is hooked to the carbons. So the two unsatisfied bonds means that this carbon that is actually part of the carbonyl, which will be one of some number of carbons in the overall molecule, that carbon can appear two different ways. And you see both ways pictured here in the example part of the column 2. One possibility is that the carbon of the carbonyl is at some tip of the overall carbon skeleton. There can be many tips because we talked about branching, right? But if it doesn't branch, if it's just a linear molecule, then it has two tips, two ends. It can have three ends, many more than that. But that's one possibility. This carbon could be at an end. And when that happens, like it does right here for propanol, then the other bond is not another carbon. It's just a hydrogen, as you see here. But notice that this carbon, which is part of the carbonyl, is at one of the tips of the skeleton. That's one overall possibility. And the other possibility is that it's somewhere else. It's not at a tip of the skeleton, which you can see right here in acetone as the example. All right, now, it doesn't have to be perfectly in the middle like it happens to be here, the second one of three. As long as it's not a tip, that's the other possibility. And those are all lumped together. So we don't give just one category of substances that contain carbonyl. We have two, depending on how it happens. And if the carbonyl is not at a tip, then that category of substances are the ketones. There's many ketones, so that's not a substance, that's a category. If it is at a tip, then instead of being a ketone, it's an aldehyde. All right. And I used to get these mixed up in my head all the time, which one's which. And one day it dawned on me, and this might help you, that aldehyde, the word, starts with an A, which is at one of the tips of the alphabet. Whereas ketone starts with a K, it's not at a tip of the alphabet. So if that helps you remember, use that. But aldehydes have the carbonyl at a tip of the skeleton. And just like we named alcohols names that end in OL to remind us that it's an alcohol, aldehydes get names that end in AL. So this is propanol that you see here, because if it were just another hydrogen here, you would have propane. It's propane-like aldehyde. It's different, by the way, from propanol. OL would mean it's an alcohol instead. It doesn't have a carbonyl. It would have a hydroxyl in it. And ketones, in general, get names that end in O-N-E to tell you that they're ketones. That's why acetone got its name. All right, now, you find these a hell of a lot in biology for one major reason, just like it was true of alcohols. Monosaccharides, which are simple sugars, we're going to be talking more about right after the test when we get into Unit 2. Simple sugars or monosaccharides they all have carbonyl groups. Just like the one you built, right? Glucose had a carbonyl group in it. And so they're either ketones or aldehydes, depending on where it is, but sugars are biologically important as fuels. Okay, next is carboxyl. And this one's a little bit more complex in terms of the number of atoms involved. It's a carbon double bonded to an oxygen, and the carbon, then it's also bonded to an OH. So when you look at the picture, it looks like there are two functional groups here, right? It looks like it's a carbonyl that you just learned, plus it's a hydroxyl that you learned before that. And technically it is. But officially, it's neither a hydroxyl nor a carbonyl. If it's in exactly this arrangement, then instead of calling it either a carbonyl or a hydroxyl, or both, I mean, it is all overall one functional group called a carboxyl. But notice that the word carboxyl is a portmanteau, which is a word made up to that blends two words like spork for a spoon fork. Carboxyl is a combination of carbonyl and hydroxyl. Just what I'm trying to point out, though, is that don't consider a carboxyl, if it exists in a molecule, to be a carbonyl or a hydroxyl. It's its own functional group when it's exactly that arrangement. Carboxyl. And this one really can't overstate the importance of in biology, because as we'll be talking about when we study the macromolecules next chapter, proteins is one of those major categories of macromolecules we're going to be looking at. And I've already told you that proteins are of paramount importance in biology. They do all the important things in cells. Well, proteins are are polymers, which means they're large molecules built by hooking together a bunch of subunits, which are monomers. In the case of protein, the polymer overall, the monomers that it's made out of, the subunits, are amino acids. And an amino acid, by definition, has a carboxyl in it. So every protein, however big it is, however many amino acids it's made out of, every one of those amino acids has a carboxyl in it. So you can't have any proteins without this thing, and impossible to think about life, therefore. This acetic acid that you see here is not actually an amino acid, but it's another example of something that contains a carboxyl group. And the overall category name for anything that includes a carboxyl is either carboxylic acids, which is pretty descriptive because carboxylic tells you there's a carboxyl there. They're called carboxylic acids because when they're put into water, they can lose a proton from that hydrogen they contain. And that's, by definition, what an acid does, as I was talking about in the pH scale. An acid is something that contains a hydrogen, and when it's put into water, it loses a proton from that hydrogen to increase the hydrogen ion concentration and therefore numerically decrease the pH value, making the solution more acidic. So they can be called carboxylic acids, which is the more descriptive term, or organic acids. And the reason why that phrase makes sense is because typical acids, like hydrochloric acid, HCl, or sulfuric acid, H2SO4, they have hydrogen in them, but they don't have any carbon in them. So, yes, they're acids, but they are not organic because there's no carbon in the whole structure. These ones have carbon, and they're also acids. So they're carboxylic acids or organic acids. Next, slide 12 now, is amino, the amino group. And whenever you see the word amino, or the root amino, as just part of a bigger word, or A-M-I-N, or amine, A-M-I-N-E, that A-M-I-N part tells you that nitrogen is involved. Or amino also. Things that have amino in them, nitrogen is part. And you can see by the functional group picture that nitrogen is part of the amino group. It's an N, which of course has a valence of 3, right? So it has to make 3 bonds. 2 of those bonds are made with individual single bonds with 2 hydrogens. That leaves one that's not met, and that's the rest of the molecule that it's hooked to. So that's an amino group. And just like I got done saying how important is carboxyl is because of amino acids containing carboxyls, well, amino acids also, every amino acid by definition has to have an amino group in it as well. That's why they're called, by the way, amino acids. This is just one example, this glycine. This is one of many possible amino acids. But they're called amino acids because they have an amino, that's the amino part of the word, the phrase, of course. And they're also carboxylic acids because they have a carboxyl group. So amino acid. And so no proteins without amino groups. That itself is indispensable to life. Sulfhydryl is next. And just looking at the picture, which of the ones we've already talked about is most similar to sulfhydryl? Which one? Hydroxyl. It's a sulfhydryl is just like a hydroxyl, except it substitutes sulfur instead of oxygen, right? Why does that fact alone make sense? That sulfur can be substituted for oxygen. Why does that make sense? Same valence. It's because it's in the same group, right? Things in the same group, which is column on the periodic table, have similar chemical properties. And this is why when you were told in the ball and stick lab to build something that had a sulfur in it, there weren't any special colors for sulfur, right? You had to use something else to represent it. Well, that wasn't just a choice that was up to you. There was only one correct answer, right? Because sulfur had to have a valence of 2, therefore two holes, therefore you used oxygen. It's just under oxygen in the periodic table. So very similar to a hydroxyl and therefore has similar chemical properties, but it's not truly an alcohol because to be an alcohol, you have to have OH. Well, notice that if it's a sulfhydryl instead, then the substance is called a thiol. Well, thio as a combining form means sulfur. So thiourea, for instance, is a sulfur-containing urea compound. Thiol literally means sulfur alcohol. So it's not truly an alcohol. The OL ending, though, indicates alcohol, right? It's not truly an alcohol, but it acts kind of like one with sulfur as a replacement. And in chemistry, that's important for various reasons. In biology, a good example of why it's important is involving amino acids again. Now, most of the amino acids that organisms use to build their proteins don't have any sulfur in them. But cysteine does. This also is an amino acid, by the way. Notice that it has an amino here and a carboxyl here. So it's an amino acid, just like this one is. But in this case, hanging off of that central carbon, you also have a group of atoms containing the sulfhydryl group. So cysteine has a sulfhydryl. When proteins are built, as we'll talk more about after the first test, you hook together a bunch of amino acids, and then they don't stay as a stretched out necklace, basically, a string of beads. It folds into a certain shape because amino acids that are part of that overall sequence interact with each other. When you bend the necklace, so to speak, and you have two cysteines, each with its own SH, and you get them near each other, they chemically react. Each of the sulfhydryls, this cysteine and another one next to it, will lose their hydrogens from the sulfhydryl, and that will empty the hole, one of the holes in the sulfur, right, for both of them, allowing the two sulfurs to be covalently bonded together. And that really stabilizes the shape of the protein. It stabilizes the structure, the shape or conformation is really important as far as function of a protein in general is concerned. So those are called disulfide bridges. We'll revisit those when we study proteins in more detail. Next is phosphate. This one, for this list of functional groups that you have to know, it's the most complex in terms of number of atoms involved. Notice that it's a phosphorus atom centrally, which is, of course, why that's the phosph part of the word phosphate. But this is a phosphorus atom, which is an element by itself. And it's connected to four different oxygens around it, doubly bonded to one. And notice that two of those oxygens are usually at the pH occurring in cells of living things. They are deprotonated or ionized, which is why they have a negative sign here. They could also be OHs, but they can lose the proton from each one of those, and therefore it's O negative. But one of those four oxygens is the connection point then to the rest of the molecule. So just remember that the phosphate group is named for phosphorus, but phosphorus is just one of five atoms in the overall group. And this one is, well, these are all indispensable to life for various reasons, but phosphate has multiple reasons why it's indispensable to life. One reason is that you cannot have any DNA or RNA without phosphate. DNA and RNA are a different category of macromolecules called nucleic acids. And so they're built by hooking together subunits. In the case of nucleic acids, though, the subunits that you hook together are called nucleotides. Every individual nucleotide has a phosphate group in it, or it's not a nucleotide. And therefore, you can't have any DNA or RNA, and therefore, no life without phosphate, just for that reason alone. Another really important reason why, an important function of phosphate is that it's part of an energy-carrying molecule that we'll talk much more about in a bit, called ATP. Adenosine triphosphate is what ATP stands for. And this is important not only in your own body, in all cells of all living organisms. ATP temporarily stores energy from whatever the food is for that cell so that that energy can then be released later to power the various activities that require energy in the cell to remain alive. And that by itself is an indispensable function. Plus, that weren't enough, phosphate groups can be hooked onto or detached from other molecules. So we have the verbs phosphorylate and dephosphorylate. A protein can be phosphorylated if you stick a phosphate onto it, and it can be dephosphorylated by taking it back off. Well, phosphorylation and dephosphorylation can act like a functional switch, an on-off switch, basically. Particularly with enzymes, which are just one example of proteins. Enzymes we'll talk about eventually, but you don't always want an enzyme to be functioning. Sometimes you want it not to function. Well, you could destroy it so that it doesn't function, but in the next minute you might need it, so you'd have to build it again. It would be nice to have a switch to turn it on and off. Phosphorylation can do that. It's either functional or non-functional, depending on whether it has the phosphate or not. And it's an easy matter to just take it on and put it on. Take it off or put it on. And then the last one for this course is the methyl group. And methyls you find on just about all organic molecules because they're kind of like filler when you think about it. If you have a carbon that is at a tip of the skeleton somewhere, it can be any tip, Then since it's at a tip, you're not going to have any more carbons, right? This will be a terminal carbon somewhere, but it has a valence of 4. So if it's only making a single bond with the rest of the molecule, you have to satisfy the valence of carbon. The easiest way to do that is just fill it up with 3 more hydrogens for 3 more bonds. So carbon with 3 hydrogens, and then the carbon also bonded to the residue, is a methyl. And just like there is phosphorylation and dephosphorylation I was just talking about, you also can have methylation and demethylation. And this is actually a major way that DNA can be controlled. DNA is a complex molecule functionally made up of genes that we'll talk about later. Genes are little sets of instructions, but genes can themselves be silenced so that they're not activated at the moment. And one way to do that is to methylate them, stick methyl groups on them, so that the cellular machinery, molecules that read the code cannot read. It's like having a book that's not available for checkout. The methyl keeps it from being read. All right, so those are the ones that you need to know for this course. In slide 13... this is just a picture of the ATP I was talking about. So we'll have a lot more to say about this molecule later, but it shows you just one of the major reasons why phosphate is so important. I like the fact that we're seeing it as an example, though, because even though we'll talk about the energy-carrying properties later, we can see that the phosphate group can be depicted in shorthand form as a P in a circle. Just be careful with that, because P by itself is not the same as P in a circle. P by itself is a phosphorus atom, just a single atom, and that's it. P with a circle around it is shorthand for that whole group, the phosphorus atom and the 4 oxygen atoms. Okay, so just realize this is just laziness. People didn't want to write the O's all over and over. But ATP is called ATP because it is adenosine connected to 3 phosphates, so adenosine triphosphate. And there's a lot of energy stored, chemical energy stored in the bonds between adjacent phosphates. So this is an energy-storing molecule, and it's storing a lot of energy in ATP form. When we need that energy to do some cellular work, we can strip off a phosphate, turning it into ADP, adenosine diphosphate, and then you have an inorganic phosphate on its own. because this phosphate is now not connected to anything containing carbon anymore. It's just inorganic phosphate. And that releases the energy that was stored in there before. But then you can reverse this. You can recharge this energy-carrying molecule by providing energy, turning it back into ATP by hooking another phosphate onto it. So that's what's happening. We'll talk a lot more about that in Unit 3, but we haven't even gotten to Unit 2 yet. We will after the first test, though. And that means the unit's over. And therefore, we're done for today, unless you have questions before the test. Anyone have anything you want to ask? No, it's on Wednesday. But and by the way, on test days, that's all we do. So, you know, when you if you're done in 20 minutes, which is possible, then hand it in and you're free to go. There's never a lecture after the test. But Wednesday's lab day, so don't go home. Anything else, though, before I stop recording? Go ahead.
How many questions?
All of them. It's 50. All five exams are identical in their structure. They are all 50 questions exactly. They are also all multiple choice, and every one of them is four choices, A, B, C, D. So that's the answers, A, B, C, D. You just have to know the correct order. And that's why you need your Scantron to bubble in the A's, B's, C's, and D's. Anything else? Yeah.
And it covers from the beginning to now?
Yes. Until this moment, everything I've said up to now is fair game for the lecture exam. But also, conversely, remember what I said the first day. If there is something in the textbook, for instance, which is not what you should be using to study for the test, something that I have not mentioned in any of these recordings, then it will certainly not be on a question. The questions come directly from the things that I say on the recordings, and that's why they're the most important things to study. Yeah? Well, only coincidentally, only because I mentioned them in both. But things that I mention only in lab and not here, no, that's strictly laboratory stuff. So that's why I call these examinations lecture examinations, really. It's all about this room. Is that it? All right, then we are adjourned.